Welcome, everyone, to Street and Curb. This is your weekly commentary on political issues. Again, at Street and Curb, we take pragmatic approaches to very complex issues. I'm your host and moderator today, Steve Carvelli. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about election coverage, and the debate. So please wait and join us in a couple minutes.
The police called after midnight when they caught our son at a drinking party. It was a real wake-up call. A policeman suggested we try Al-Anon family groups. I didn't want to go to a meeting, but I'm glad I did. Are you troubled by someone else's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-Al-Anon or go to alanon.org.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. My name is Steve Carvelli. I'm your host and moderator. And I use the term moderator because I want to start out today talking about the upcoming debate. The debate's coming up soon. It's part of the election process every year. However, it's coming in June for an election in November. So that in itself is uncharacteristic of the debate process. It's not being given through the debate commission. It's being provided through CNN's rules. So each candidate will have to follow the CNN rules. What makes this really unique is that there are separate rules here. Number one, they have a mic policy that if you're not speaking, the opposing person's mic will be turned off. There is no audience and there are podiums. So I guess my initial thought is that we'll probably have one candidate likely to storm off stage about something and the other candidate's likely to wander off. And you can figure out which ones I'm referring to. Again, it is the earliest debate. And it's an interesting idea here on why the debate is early. It is early because we have two geriatric representatives of their respective parties. And it is believed that one of them blows up something on the debate. It will give them ample time to correct themselves before the September debate, so it's not as damaging as if all the debates came in the fall. It's kind of sad when we have to think about damage control on a June debate, but this is where we are in politics. Another interesting thing is that what does this debate remind you of? It reminds me of something that if you're at an old folks' home, and you have two people who have played cards, let's say, for the last 8 years, which these two gentlemen have known each other and debated each other for the last 8 years. They have known each other. They ran in the last election. They had a process of building up to the last election that lasted years. So it's like two old people playing at a card match who play every week. They disagree about everything. They disagree about everything except about the cards, and it's an ongoing process that goes on every week at the same old folks' home. That's what this debate's going to be like. It's a bad cliche. It's a bad picture, but it's where this country is right now. This election is truly a watershed election. It's interesting in the fact that if we compare the both candidates and we'll compare them in a lot of avenues and a lot of issues, and we'll figure out where this country needs to go and what the processes are for us to start correcting the bad processes that seem to be plaguing the country. One of the things that I think this election and maybe this debate will focus on is foreign affairs in the foreign arena. The focus should be on the future. We seem to be having a new Cold War alliance between powers such as North Korea, Russia, China, to a limited extent, Iran. Matter of fact, North Korea and Russia just signed a mutual defense policy, kind of like their anti-NATO defense. And we seem to have a new Cold War structure being formed in the country, in the world, I mean. So again, it's going to be interesting on how each candidate deals with these issues and how each candidate moves forward. Can Biden really deal with the stressors of keeping NATO unified? As we see in the Ukraine issue, in which there are some issues of members of NATO, namely Turkey and Hungary, that have expressed interest of not supporting Ukraine and not supporting the NATO initiatives on Ukraine. How is Biden going to be able to move forward in dealing with these type of issues? Now, it's interesting that if we compare the other candidate, Donald Trump, how he would deal with the alliances of North Korea, Russia, and China. I think it would be a lot different. I think it would be a lot less, a little more problematic in the long, in the short term, but much more problematic in the long term. Trump seems to placate Russia. He seems to placate China to some extent. Biden uses tariffs as a offset against China. It's interesting to see what Trump would use if he would use tariffs also. The second big issue in foreign arena is, of course, Iran. And under Biden administration, the sanctions have been lowered. The sanctions have not necessarily been enforced to the effect of the law that has been followed for the sanctions. And Iran remains a viable threat to Israel, and it adds additional instability to the Mideast. It's interesting how Donald Trump would deal with that, probably a little more confrontational in rhetoric, but I don't think there is probably a recourse to him that's any different than Biden's. Third issue of foreign affairs comes to Lebanon and its housing of Hezbollah, which is a terrorist organization recognized by this country. There is a threat here of an all-out war with Israel. It has been magnified lately with the cross-border ramifications of shooting and missiles firing back and forth. But can Biden handle a multiple front war run by Israel without trying to placate the left at home? For an interesting sake, it is, looks like that Biden kind of waffles or vacillates between appeasing the left in this country, which is an all-out protest against the Israeli occupation of Gaza, and then again having to support Israel because he has expressed unmitigating support for the Israeli state. Now, I don't know how Trump may vary from this a little bit. I think he'll be a little more confrontational against Hezbollah. But again, it's interesting that we have two people of diametrically different opposites of the political spectrum may mirror each other, at least on the Lebanon-Hezbollah front. Another issue in regards to foreign affairs is the status of NATO. NATO is a North Atlantic Treaty Alliance that we are a firm member and a heavily contributory member, both in a number of personnel that we use and monetarily. Trump has a definite opinion of NATO and is not necessarily pro-NATO. He focuses less on emphasis on the collective whole of NATO and more responsibility to individual nations to defend themselves and support their position. On the face of this, this seems a little bit more isolationist than perhaps this country would like. It is, again, a position that seems to indicate that we will withdraw to some extent from NATO, maybe not honor the commitments of NATO, maybe not support it financially as we have been in the past. But I think that that position alone, that isolationism, when you have a very expansionist philosophies of China and Russia and possibly North Korea, probably it's not a good mix. So when we look at things in the NATO perspective, it does look like that Biden may be a little more accommodating to supporting NATO and supporting the collective whole, and Trump may not be. Is another interesting aspect on the foreign side of how our relationship with Russia will go. Donald Trump seems to have more of a placative attitude towards Putin. It is a little more accommodating, and he a little more accepts a little bit more about Putin does. Now, that is kind of an isolationist approach that seems to indicate that Putin can have his way with some of the ex-Russian satellites in the European spectrum. He can continue his war in Ukraine. He could probably press his positions with areas such as Georgia or some other outlining, maybe the Baltic states. But it is not good for the overall emphasis of NATO, and it's not good for the overall power and position that this country has as a foreign power. It is interesting that the Trump foreign policy, perhaps it would be a little more decided to and discussed in the debate, has not gotten a lot of press play, has not gotten a lot of pushback in this country, because as a populist or a proposed populist, Donald Trump seems to resonate a lot with people who do not want to get involved in foreign affairs. So this is interesting because, you know, we're looking at two people diametrically opposed, and especially on foreign policy. It'll be interesting on how they engage each other in the debate. You know, China will be the elephant in the room. Biden seems to be respond to China through increased tariffs. Trump, on the other hand, seems to accommodate China as a byproduct of capitalism. If China should make an aggressive expansion towards a military involvement towards Taiwan, or maybe a military issue against the Philippines in regards to some disputed islands, it would be interesting on how each party responds. Now, this country has a understanding. I don't know how far the understanding goes, that we will defend Taiwan in case of an aggression, but we do not have that type of understanding with the Philippines in regards to any type of aggression on those islands. So it is an interesting dichotomy here. I do not think either party and either candidate is well positioned for dealing with some of the future impacts that will affect this country. And this is not far in the future. This is probably going to materialize 1 to 2 years into the new presidency. So I do feel that on foreign policy or future focus on foreign policy, that neither candidate presents a viable, sustainable, or correct position in regards to foreign relations. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some wild card possibilities. We're going to talk about domestic policy, how each candidate rolls up on that as we get ready for the first debate. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back here on Street and Curb.
We all come together and stand together to serve our veterans. We invest in the latest technology.
We take the time to train the next generation of doctors and nurses. We work together to make sure we heal their bodies and their minds.
This is our mission. More than 300,000 of us working as one, together with families and loved ones. No matter where they live in this country, we'll be there.
We stand strong, united. Stand with us in caring for our veterans.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host and moderator today, Steve Parvelli, where we talk about politics, economics, finance, quality of life, the American way of life, hopefully tackling some of the big issues of the day with a pragmatic approach. And I want to go back a little bit to the foreign policy discussion we were just having with the both presidential candidates, or the both major presidential candidates so far. And that is, what happens if we have a wild card issue in foreign policy, or a black swan event? A black swan event is an event that's not seen coming and has lasting and big ramifications for everybody. Now, a quick aggression of China into Taiwan, I don't know, would be considered a black swan event because a lot of think tanks have already put that into their equation. But any type of terrorist event, again, not sure if it's a black swan event, but at least it's a wild card event. How would these potential candidates and potential presidents respond? I'm not sure how Biden would respond to a terrorist attack if it was done in a foreign soil, or in a foreign embassy of ours, or in domestic soil. I'm sure he would posture towards the right and have a military response. I believe Donald Trump would have an immediate military response that may not consider the ramifications of how to sustain the response or who actually the culprits were. So Trump would be more of a quick draw type of person. And I think Biden would be a weaker draw, but he would draw and it would be much more prolonged and protracted. So now let's look at some of the domestic issues that both these candidates faced. Well, I guess there is another war going on, and that is the war on fossil fuels. Biden is hell-bent on eliminating gas-powered cars. Not sure how that is going along with the public. The public actually has some pushback on that. EV sales have plateaued. There is more of a demand for hybrid versus strict EV. And again, if I'm part of the consumer and the buying public, who I will never buy an EV, I just don't see how that is viable as a sustainable way. And what's also interesting about that is that there is a union issue here. Biden really works with the Detroit unions, who are still primarily building gas-powered cars. They are shifting a little bit, but it's interesting on how that would run. There was a kind of unforeseen or irony here, is that the conversion to electric vehicles, the electric grid is mostly supported and supplied by fossil fuels. So the more demand on the electric grid, the more use of fossil fuels. Other countries, such as China, pretty much utilizes coal for a big majority of their industrial production. So I don't know how much work we can do in this country by buying an EV that makes a difference in the world that is shared by a lot of parties who are not into eliminating fossil fuels. Namely, we share the same earth. So if we're conscientious in this side of the world and China is not, what benefit does that have for the whole earth? Again, there is a misconception that EV is environmentally clean. It is not. There is a decided benefit by using batteries, at least in the short term when it comes to expenditure of fuel. However, they rely on rare earth minerals that are predominantly received from and mined out of China, which again gives them a little more control over this. So again, how would we view this? I think Trump would roll back a lot of the EV push and a lot of the war of fossil fuels would kind of dissipate with Trump. I think Biden's going to push it forward no matter what. And you do have some governors in certain states, such as New York, that really are pushing the end of fossil fuels that, you know, is creating a lot of unforeseen consequences, as they say, in regards to cost to the consumer. So again, this is a difference of how they view this, but it's, we'll have to wait and see. I don't think either party is necessarily correct and correct position on this. I do think there is some change in the global environment. However, I don't know how we should address it and balance short-term economic livelihoods of people versus long-term environmental concerns. Another issue on the domestic front is foreign interference in domestic affairs. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, number one, disinformation. Just look for the example of TikTok. TikTok gets a lot of negative publicity because it is owned by a foreign entity who is not on our good list, namely China. And this creates an issue on how much information they have. We have a very big push to ban TikTok. And then we have on the other side, a very big push calling it free expression that does not want to ban it. But there's also a lot of other issues. There's a lot of cyber scams that are developed overseas by our adversaries, such as China and Russia, hackers, interference of websites and so forth that create a lot of disruption in this country. We don't seem to have any real response to this. I don't think the Biden administration has been strong to respond. And if we have ascertained that it is coming from one country or one actor to another, we don't seem to have a strong response to that. You know, we don't want them touching our critical infrastructure. We don't want them to touch missile silos or Defense Department issues. But is that talk enough? I do think Trump would be a little more forceful on this. But again, unless we really have a counterintelligence that we also do the same thing to them as they do to us, I don't think there's really going to be an adequate defense on this. Now, I'm not promoting that hackers go after Russian or Chinese entities to disrupt them, but I think that probably a function of the government or some kind of intelligence department may look into that somewhere down the line. And that may be the only real response. Now, on the domestic environment, now, how would quality of life be under both of these candidates? Well, Trump is generally portrayed as a vindictive little dictator who would be very quick to weaponize any department or any government institution to go against his enemies. He's actually stated some stuff like that, but the left really portrays it that way. Matter of fact, there are some left politicians who believe that they would be imprisoned under a Donald Trump administration. It's kind of like a throwback to the gulag mentality I don't know how valid that argument is, but again, it is galvanizing people from one party to the other. Biden, on the other hand, it's interesting. I believe he really believes that the Democratic Party should be a one-party rule in this country because that's what's good for the country. It is not necessarily open to the democratic process, but the Democratic Party, he believes, is one good thing for the country. And he does that by opening up citizenship rights and responsibilities to non-citizens, by giving illegal migrants in certain municipal elections the right to vote, expanding their citizenship role, expanding their ability to work. So again, it is an interesting proposition that I believe that Joe Biden looks to marginalize citizenship. Now, it's also a big issue coming up is the migration. Illegal migration, whether it's justifiable or not justifiable, we have to look at the migrants who are coming in the country. Probably a good 94% of them are economic refugees. They are not political asylum seekers who would be granted asylum. Now, there's always been economic refugees. There's always a country doing better than someone else. It doesn't mean that we should have an unfettered border for people to just cross to get that way. Not everyone can live in the United States. Political asylum is one thing, but if probably only 5 to 6% will ever be granted political asylum to stay in this country legally versus 94% that would have to leave because they're economic refugees, if we let them run in this country until their court dates for 2 or 3 years down the function, we're basically giving them a carte blanche to stay in the country. Now, again, not all refugees should be allowed to stay. Economic refugees should not, but it's a question of how both candidates view them. Biden views them as prospective voters that would vote on their side. Trump may view them as prospective workers. However, I think his position will be to limit their access and create a much more structured approach to come in the country. So we have that type of proposition, but the elephant in the room is going to come down to this. No matter who wins the next election, there is a definite possibility of a VP takeover. I don't remember any election where both sides are calling for a cognitive test on the other. It's kind of disconcerting that when we have to take cognitive tests of the leader of the free world who has control of the nuclear arsenal, of the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world, that we have to do a cognitive test. But the definite possibility, at least we know on Biden's side, it would be Kamala Harris. We're not sure who it is on the Trump side yet. But when you vote this year, you're going to have to make a vote on the second tier, that whether who was ever running as vice president has a definite possibility within the term of the next administration of taking over the presidency. And that alone should scare almost everyone in the country. So not only are we voting for the top of the ticket, we're voting for the second on the ticket who'll probably take over the top of the ticket. So it's a two-tiered approach in this election. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to do our closing arguments, let's say, for the debate. And then, we'll see you next week. But we're going to take a quick break in here right now.
Hi, I'm Kelsey Grammer. Wounded Warrior Project supports injured veterans by connecting them with fellow warriors, by serving them through mental health and wellness programs, and by empowering them to live on their own terms. No one should face a battle alone. Join us at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli. And we're talking about the election candidates this week. And again, we talked about foreign policy, domestic policy. But again, we have to talk about the quality of life and the quality of discourse in this country. Does either candidate offer any possibility of a lowering of the lack of civility and the hostility of discourse in this country? I don't believe either candidate does. Trump is an instigator. He really rallies the base and he polarizes the other side. Joe Biden is not the placator. He's not the peacemaker. He does not reach across the aisle very often, even though in his senatorial career, he claims he does. And I don't think either party will lower the lack of civility and will lower the rank and personal attacks that are going on in this country. So again, where do we stand? If there's any time for a third party, it is right now. Now, we do have RFK running. Actually, he's probably not going to make the debate. But it's interesting that third parties today are so concerned, third party candidates are so concerned of spoiling the election so that the other party wins. We have people on the Democratic side who don't want to run because they think they'll take votes away from Biden to help Trump. And we have people on the right or the moderate side of the Republican Party who don't want to run because they think they'll hand the election to Biden. That's not what a third party option is. A third party option has to have a plan and a program and an incentive and a belief and a faith that they can win the election. Therefore, anyone else running for a third party who's acting as a spoiler, who's acting as a way of a conduit just to get draw votes from one candidate to the other, for not really getting the votes to actually win the election, it's not a third party. A third party today who would be there's a viable pathway to victory because the middle of the country, the socially a little left of center people, but fiscally conservative and fiscally moderate people, have no one to vote for in this election. We have 350 million Americans in this country, and we have two candidates who need cognitive tests, who'll probably need cognitive tests in the next term, in their presidential term. And it's the same people we had running 4 years ago who polarized the nation, who do nothing about bridging the divide, who have diametrically different opinions about the role of the military, the role of the country, and the role of institutions. And we are faced with the possibility of, again, electing the lesser of two evils. That, to me, is not an option. The lesser of two evils and a vibrant democracy is not a choice. It is a sentence. And this is something that we have to really understand in this country. It's something that we're going to talk about on Street and Curb in the upcoming weeks, is that we should not be living and voting because it's a sentence, because we have to vote. We should be doing it because it's a viable option forward. So join us next week when we continue our discussion on Street and Curb. And again, we invite you to join us every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on this channel. So we'll continue the discussion next week. Everyone have a good week. And remember, think wisely and vote wisely as we come up.